When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Because it's time, it's time for reparations.
LGBTIQ rights are black rights. We have always been here. Black queers, we will always be here.
It's like, it's a form of cultural imperialism.
The only thing I have in common with this character is that she's black. This does not look like me or sound like me.
I'm Gary Foley.
I'm Francesca Ramsey.
This is Amir Rahman.
And you're listening to The Race Card.
Welcome to The Race Card. I'm your host, Ahmed Yusuf, and joining me in studio today, we've got Amina Ziyart.
Hey.
As well as Darren Parker.
Hey.
Darren's going to be our guest today, and before we begin, before we begin, we'd like to do an acknowledgement of country. We acknowledge the Kulin people as the owners of land in which we meet, and pay our respects to the elders both past and present. This land was never ceded in the process of colonization, occupation, incarceration, and genocide that began over two centuries ago, continue to this day. You're listening to our one-hour show where we talk politics, current affairs, pop culture, with a little bit of a twist. And as I said before, academic Darren Parker is in studio today to talk to us about him and a lot of other things. I will leave that for a little bit later, as well as we're going to be looking at the backlash of former rugby player Joe Williams, receiving after deciding not to stand for the national anthem. Also looking at the Australian of the Year awardee, David Morris, on his call to the bamboo ceiling, I should say, and feature on memification or memeization. We'll leave that to later. And now let's go into that interview. Thanks for coming on the show, Darren.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's great. I'm going to give you a proper introduction, I should say. You know, Darren is an academic who specializes in public law, constitutional law, and Aboriginal cultural heritage. And I guess specifically in Australia, where Indigenous culture is so heavily politicized, we're looking back at just 2015, Adam Goods. How do you feel? What do you do to kind of try to make Indigenous culture, and with your work, I guess more mainstream?
It's an interesting question in that way, because it runs a sort of a double-edged sword in many ways, is that, and I say this to both of you as well, you know, your cultures are your cultures, and you want to respect them for that very reason. You don't also, and I'm speaking for myself here, is that that seems to be enough. And it should be enough. But in many ways in Australia, Aboriginal cultural heritage, to gain respect, or the adequate respect it fully deserves, needs to be promulgated out into the greater, wider society. And to some extent, there's a bit of a lessening of it in many ways, of like, well, okay, if we take one of the major cases in Aboriginal cultural heritage, the Tasmania Dams case from back in the early 80s, that all turned around on particular etchings in a cave down in Tasmania that the High Court ruled on, and it's actually, you know, codified in the High Court judgment, so to speak, that it was there for humanity. So it sort of detracts from, there's this sort of philosophical separation from the very people whose culture it is, most in a direct lineage fashion, then being sort of co-opted out, if I can use such a term, to the greater populace, and it becomes like this sort of weakening of it. But at the same time, again, this is that catch-22. Unless people have a working knowledge to some degree of it, how are they able to respect it in the right fashion? See, Aboriginal cultural heritage laws aren't directly under the Commonwealth government. They mainly fall to state and territory governments. So we get a piecemeal sort of quagmire in terms of Western Australia does this, Victoria does this, Queensland does this. So it becomes, you know, patchwork, so to speak. And sad to say, the greatest threat to Aboriginal cultural heritage sites, actual physical manifestation sites, is from vandalism. So, again, can you sort of see what I'm saying about, like, you sort of walk this fine line in that way. In terms of what you were putting to me in terms of Adam Goods and the imaginary spear and, you know, white people's imaginary feelings, that too is something that's problematic in terms of protection of Aboriginal cultural heritage laws, is that the laws themselves only pertain to physical manifestation, physical objects. They've yet to sort of cross that rubric over into the intangible. And again, I put it back to you guys, and, you know, just a simple sort of question, you know, is all of your cultures tangible?
No. Or is,
yeah, exactly.
It's impossible to have your culture in its entirety to be tangible. We're talking about whether it be language. Language is not something you can actually feel or see unless it's written down, and a lot of languages are just oral.
Exactly.
Like particularly Somali, for example, it wasn't made to be written until the British came and said, hey, you know, you guys should use our alphabet, you know what I mean? Before that, it was oral language. And something I would like to touch on what you said is, you know, kind of like the making Indigenous culture palatable and kind of diluting it. Are we seeing that, like, especially now, it's fashionable to be okay with Indigenous people to a point and kind of dilute it in that extent? Do you get what I mean?
Yeah, I certainly do. Well, look, I mean, we don't have to stray too far from that Goods example again. You know, and I can sort of, you know, contrast that in terms of the recent Stan Grant video or Noel Pearson's speech at the National Press Club just last week. Australia, like in terms of like mainstream Australia, quite readily accept a black person, an Aboriginal person, speaking to them and pointing out certain discrepancies, if I can put it in a general sense like that. But it then becomes a sort of issue about how is that put to them? Is it being put to them in a very acceptable fashioned metropole of whiteness? So when we got Stan Grant, who's a very eloquent speaker, Noel Pearson, who's a very eloquent orator himself, you know, and us mob, and when I say us mob, like many in the black community, we hear this time and time again. Oh, he speaks so well. Oh, he's such a good talker. And I can't help, personally again, can't help but sort of feel that tinge of like, oh, you've come along so well, you know, this little project that we're working on has paid off dividends right here. You know, like, it sort of reminds me of a story when I was doing my PhD and a fellow PhD candidate was standing there and we were sort of exchanging, you know, pleasantries and whatnot. We knew each other quite well, but it was just that small talk in the sort of corridors. And they asked me to read some of my stuff. And I was like, yeah, fine, not a problem. Handed over, you know, one of the recent articles I'd just finished. And they came back to me later in the day and I'm sitting at my desk typing away, doing whatever. And the first thing they said to me was, you write really well. And I'm sitting there gobsmacked going, I'm in the PhD program just like you are. You know, would you say that to somebody else? Would you say that, and by somebody else, would you say that to another white person? Like, honestly, would you be saying that? It's like, you sort of sit there and I'm gobsmacked and I'm hardly the type of person to be lost for words. as your listeners are probably going to find out. But I am just gobsmacked going like, I'm not sure, and I don't want to speak for you guys, but have you ever had someone say that? You know, oh, you speak really well.
You speak good English.
Very much.
Oh, you speak really good
all
English.
All
the time.
Oh, my God.
All the time.
Oh, but what you say about Sandgren really kind of, like, I remember seeing all that kind of like backlash after him, not really backlash, just reaction really, after he said that. And I feel like people talking about it being Australia's MLK moment. I'm like thinking, why are we rewriting history? I don't know, maybe Australia's MLK moment came a lot longer, farther back than that. Like, I'm pretty sure, like, you know better than me, like, about Indigenous people fighting for the right to be even human.
Yeah, well, like, that's a thing. And, have you ever heard the expression cultural cringe?
Yeah.
Yeah. You ever heard that expression?
No, I actually haven't.
No?
I haven't.
Okay. Kind of like, how can I explain it? Sort of like the way, because Australia in one sense is such a young nation, it's constantly sort of looking up to the rest of the world, and it's looking up to what in our history was particularly, it was like the motherland, it was England, you know, and more recently in terms of, you know, the last 20 or so years, 30 years, it's been the USA. So there's always this sort of like, oh, no, we're good enough. No, we're really, it's like the youngest in the family always trying to show off and prove up to the older siblings sort of thing. So there's a lot of that sort of cultural cringe. And when that came out with, like, MLK, like, many of us were just sitting there going, what the hell? What are you so, you know, derived of your own history that you still, like, pointing out to the rest of the world going, look at us. No, really, we're good enough. No, come on, we're really good enough. You know, I read an article in the paper this morning about Lucy Turnbull being like the Jackie O moment of showing people around the lodge. And I'm going like, oh, fuck. I don't want to swear on your podcast, but like, oh, give me a break, please. You know, so when we heard this MLK moment, it was a bit, it was quite farcical. Regardless of people's good intention, and I'll just assume they had good intentions by saying it, it was just like, oh, that was insipid. It was truly insipid. Particularly when we look to, like, the strong, strong advocates we've had throughout Indigenous history in terms of its impact and its pushback against colonisation. So, yeah, it's a bit farcical. The other thing I noticed about that is that we seem to be, I wouldn't say replicating it. I think that's too strong an expression, but we're certainly being rewarded by white society in terms of only our men are starting to get all of this, well, not starting to, but all, are getting the sort of recognition in terms of the national debate, Pearson, you know, Grant, Goods. Well, you know, I come from a matrilineal family and culture where it's our Aboriginal women who are the stalwarts in the pushback against white society and whiteness and, you know, right, oppression and subjugation. You know, my mother is undoubtedly my all-time hero. You know, there doesn't be... It's her and then, you know, daylight second sort of thing. And certainly I've spoken to other mob and, you know, that's right across the country who also notice this and also push back on it as well. You think about, okay, just for an instance, you know, the current chair of the Indigenous Forum at the UN, Megan Davis, you know, cobble woman from Queensland. You know, professor of law at, where is it? The University of New South Wales. You know, but
there's tons of, like, there's even, I met Auntie Jenny Munro.
Jenny Munro, yeah, like, Marcia Langton.
Oh, we've had Mariki. We've had Mariki on the,
Mariki.
Yeah, like, there's so many.
Yeah, and it's strange because, like, it just seems to me as, you know, and I say it with the greatest of irony, being a, you know, Indigenous man sitting here being interviewed on your podcast, so I'm well aware of that irony as well. But it seems to me that there's trying to be this sort of replication put onto us by white society, which is, look, you know, it's a patriarchal society. It certainly is.
Yeah.
And I certainly, as I've said, I certainly know from my culture, we don't work like that. You know, not at all. But, yeah.
Talking about Indigenous culture, and I find very interesting is how a lot of non-Indigenous people, and I've been just as guilty as this in the past, how people think Indigenous people should be looking, and how they should, and I'm pretty sure with your facial reaction, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And this week I was reading this article in The Conversation. It's a couple of months old.
Yep.
It's about Aboriginal identity being more about culture than colour. And a quote that I got from it is, Aboriginal people do not rely on race-based identity. In fact, while those people writing their life stories and their family histories are often interested in acknowledging non-Aboriginal ancestors, they do not identify with them. They continue to be Aboriginal. So talk to me about how a lot of non-Indigenous people continually talking about how Indigenous people should be looking.
Oh, it runs the gamut. Like, I certainly in my experience, that runs a complete spectrum from, like, you don't look Aboriginal, you know, those sort of off the cuff, which, you know, I have no sort of apologies about. I am a smart ass in some instances, and sometimes people need that sort of kick up the bum to, you know, make them, at least in that instance, in that immediate instance, more aware. Because I've had it, you know, time and time again. You don't look Aboriginal. Yeah, you don't look like a dickhead, but here we both are. You know, we're both standing right here, you know. Things like that. No, so it can come from appearance. We've got, like, you know, a very infamous court case that was basically off the back of a series of articles or blogs, I think. And they essentially went back to, you know, that discredited pseudoscience of eugenics and, like, blood quantum. You know, how much... And again, you know, questions that Mob and myself have heard time and time again, you know. What part Aboriginal are you? Well, it's my left foot, the one I'm about to stick in your backside, you know. It's just, you know, from appearance sake, and then it comes down to, well, do you speak language? Do you know your culture? Do you live on your country? There's a whole sort of, as I said, there's a spectrum where people come at you from that sort of, it's sort of like an attitude of someone who knows, I'll say, little to nothing about our actual culture or cultures, seeing that there's, you know, quite a few of them, a couple of hundred, coming at you as if they're some sort of expert in the field, and they want you to prove to them that you are actually Aboriginal enough to satisfy their test. And there should be, like, a little asterisk next to their test, because then when you read the fine print, test may vary. You know,
yeah.
It's such a subjective thing. Is this sort of what you were talking about?
I see it so often that people talk about Indigenous culture in this way. And I kind of think, like, for example, if I do not look... I'm Somali, and a lot of Somalis are black. So if my family go along the line of not being as darker skin as Somali people should be looking like, does that mean the people that are going to be my kin are not going to be Somali anymore? It's just this idea of how... This strange idea of, it's also very white supremacist as well. You're conditioning your identity to being how you should look.
Yeah, it's massively so. And that's something that many of us Mob actually, you know, tell our next generations, is that, you know, culture is not a skin colour and it's not bound up in your melatonin or your lack thereof. You know, it's in what you do day to day, and it's in your praxis. You know, if I give you a fine example, I've got three great nieces under the age of 8. All of them are under the age of 8. And all of them can pretty much speak fluent Ngunnawal and Gunungurra. And the eldest, Coops, she speaks Wiradjuri as well.
Wow. So, like, I don't even speak Somali. Like, I'm just like, saying.
I mean, and they speak it fluently. And yeah. We speak it at home. My mum and I hold conversations in language. You know, it wasn't there for many years, but then both of us got so, you know, not frustrated. Frustrated's not the right word, but we were just so struck by how powerful our culture is that we couldn't let it remain untouched. So we revitalized our language. We both sat in the, you know, the National Library, went to IATSIS. We've also spoken to other of our relos, other mob as well, and we're revitalizing our language. We started out with a, you know, I've still got the piece of paper in my files. You know, we started out with a list of nouns, you know, just naming things, and we'd name things, and that pretty much spurred us off again.
I guess that's a great example of, you know, a lot of people say things are not how they used to be, but the thing is, nothing will ever be how it used to be.
No.
And culture, just as anything, is always revitalizing itself. It's always changing.
That is an excellent point, because if, quite simply, and it doesn't matter who you are, if you don't adapt, you die.
Yeah.
You know, and culture does that, and it has to do that.
Yeah.
And I mean, look, if we're going to turn around and say, and, you know, make the absolute, you know, factual claim that we've been here millennia, it'd be ludicrous to think that our culture has not adapted over millennia. You know, and I also see that, and that's beautiful to see. It's absolutely, you know, heartwarming to see, is young mob and younger generations, and my generation as well, digitizing. You know, and we're using all of this, you know, new technology, tech that we've grown up with, basically, and we're using it in a way which sustains and affirms culture, you know. And I can also throw back to, like, you ever been over to Bundjalaka at the museum?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Have you seen those spearheads that were chipped out of glass?
Ooh, I cannot remember that far.
There's a row of spearheads.
Oh, okay. Sorry, just came to my mind, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, okay, I do remember.
And it was from, like, old bottles.
Yeah.
And they'd actually, the mob had chipped away, and they'd made perfect, absolutely perfect spearheads. Now, this was a product, a technology that had been introduced. Mob adapted to it.
Yeah.
Like that, you know. So I don't see it in principle any different.
Definitely. And especially where you say about the internet, that's like, and technology in general, that is so powerful in preserving things that otherwise would have been lost by burning of documents and what have you. And that now can reaffirm and make sure that's there for the next generation.
Right.
That's right.
And the other thing that I was thinking was the accessibility of knowledge. Would you like to speak on that?
No, go. Well? What were you going to say?
I was just going to say, I feel a lot of the time we have this idea that to connect with our culture, we need to go back to our home countries, or we need to go back, you know, do somersaults or something.
Yeah.
Basically, like cultural somersaults to get that information. But I think the great thing with the internet is that that somersault can be more like a head turn, you know what I mean?
No, that's a great analogy. That's a really good analogy for it. And it's certainly true in terms of, if I just take like something as sort of run-of-the-mill and accepted or ubiquitous as Twitter, you know. I sit on Twitter and I talk to mob over in Western Australia, up in the Kimberley, over in Darwin, you know, across in Port Narralonga, you know, right across the country is the sort of, you know, point I'm trying to make. And we feed off each other in many ways in terms of, like, what are you doing? How's this working? Oh, I've got a question here on this sort of thing. You know, all of that sort of stuff. That beautiful sharing of story and knowledge is just phenomenal in terms of a digital medium.
The week that was.
This is Amir Rahman, and you're listening to The Race Card.
Now we're into our segment, The Week That Was, where we highlight the most notable and interesting stories, or infamous stories, of the week. First up, we look at a story that developed after Indigenous man Joe Williams decided not to stand for the national anthem in a ceremony where he received a Wagga Wagga Citizen of the Year. Williams was immediately criticised for his decision by councillor Paul Funnell, who said, if he was struggling so gravely to accept the award and he refuses to stand for the national anthem, he should hand it back. If that's the disrespect he has for our national anthem and our nation, he should have never accepted the award. This is the highest Australian honour at our local level, and he refuses to respect the country. I absolutely respect his right to have an opinion. I want to make that clear, but this is divisive, not unifying. That was Paul Funnell, funnily enough. But before we even get into discussing this Indigenous person deciding not to stand for an anthem that doesn't represent him potentially, and in a country that hasn't recognised him as a human up until 1967, where's that, you know, that little thing called freedom of expression that our democracy that we so-called have says we have? Or did I miss that memo somewhere? You think it ends there. Mr. Funnell went out and had an interesting conversation with a few people on the project where he asked for manners. He asked, Mr. Williams, where were your manners?
All I ask is that just show the respect, or some may say the protocol, the manners to stand up. I'm not asking Joe or anyone else to accept the national anthem or anything, but if someone gives you an award, please just have the manners to stand up. Joe, I just believe there was a chance where you wouldn't want to give me the chance to...
Yeah, you know, those manners, you know, those basic manners. Before we get to what Joe replied, I want to ask you, Darren, what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, where do you begin? I can't get past the manners at the moment. Sorry.
I think I've left you short there. It doesn't end there, actually. Oh. You know, Mr. Funnell, you know, he believes he might be Indigenous.
If Joe, I gave you the chance, but if you wouldn't mind just giving me the chance to say my piece, I'm happy to have the debate as we've shown before. But let's not disrespect people such as myself or my family. I'm Indigenous to this country too, and have been since 1792 when our family came out as convicts.
His family came to Australia as convicts, but he is Indigenous. Darren, I don't particularly understand what he's trying to say.
I think what he's trying to say is, because his family has stayed here for 200 years or plus, somehow he's native. That's you know, native whiteness talking.
Amina has a really interesting story. When she came to Australia, she was like, because I'm...
Oh, I can tell your story. So when I was new to Australia, I was, you know, hanging around a lot of Australians.
White people.
My commiserations.
White people. And I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know that, you know, the word was Aboriginal or like Indigenous. And I said Native. Because, you know, you say Native American. I thought it was Native Australian. And I remember I would ask people, oh, I would like to learn more about Native Australia. And they would always say, oh, yeah, we can show you Native Australia. And then they started talking about Lemingtons. They started talking, you know what I mean? They started talking about things like that. And then I was like, okay, guys, this is not what I had in mind. I think we understand this very differently. And once I told them that, like, oh, by Native Australia, I really mean Indigenous, then everyone just got quiet. And the way how they had imagined what is native to Australia was obviously very, well, I guess very whitewashed. I guess you, not even whitewashed, but they were, they felt that they were, they owned the land. Like they felt they were entitled.
Yeah.
That was, yeah, that was my experience.
I'd like to say that's sort of a rare story I've heard from people, but it's not, sad to say. But then again, and not to dismiss it, is to say, well, you could actually, if you wanted to, you could get together with a lot of friends and you could make like an anthology. So... just a thought.
Yeah, like, I'm pretty sure there's a lot of people with very similar stories.
Yeah, I think there'd be a few of them stories out there running around. But you're right. You know, it's a very sterilized and blinkered kind of way of viewing the world and the history of this country. Yeah, more so is that no, you know. History only began at 1788, you know, and my family's been on this land for, you know, six generations, and like as us mob, we're you know, very very used to hearing those sort of statements, and you just sit there and go, yeah, six generations, wow, that's awesome.
How about 60,000 years?
Yeah, exactly, you know, sort of thing. But going back to, oh God. Funnel statement. Where do you even start to deal with someone like that? I noticed that in terms of him using that he's Indigenous and in his family are Indigenous since 1792, was it? 1792? Thereabouts.
Whatever. Numbers.
Yeah. It's actually a restatement of Pauline Hanson's maiden speech in Parliament.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Where she was actually, you know, stating the exact same thing. She's Indigenous to this country. This is in relation to, was the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People and whether Australia would sign it or not. At the time, no, we weren't signing it. And there was a bit of a scare tactic. Fancy the Australian Parliament putting out scare tactics. I'm shocked. About how it would create a plurality in the law, one rule for them, one rule for us, sort of thing, which was totally nonsense, absolutely farcical. But she was actually saying, you know, I'm Indigenous to this country. This is my country. I've been here for so many generations. My family have. And now, yeah, we can just relate it in terms of simply, you know, an equation of like, well, 200 years or thereabouts stacked up against, you know, millennia, 60,000 and then some. But I think also what Funnel has done there and what I think, you know, when he's talking about manners, is exactly what I was saying to you previously in the show about, like, you know, a black man or a black woman can push back against white society, but they must do so in the most, you know, confined fashion as predisposed by white people and whiteness. So what he's actually talking about there is, like, whiteness is the metropole. You must... you know, you must adhere to the rules, and again, rules may vary, to the metropole, and that being whiteness. Now, you know, as he said, you know, oh, I've got no problem with Joe getting this award, but he should have just done this in the right way. Well, no, sorry, but the, you know, the democracy and individuals don't operate in that fashion. It wasn't hurting anyone. You know, didn't hurt anyone. He didn't upset anyone except someone who, you know, like Fennell, can't see past his own bloody shadow.
You know what that reminds me of? It reminds me of, you know, Eddie Maguire.
Oh, God.
You know, if only Adam Goods had told the stadium, if only he told the security.
Everyone would have been happy about it.
Yeah, like
we would have just embraced him.
He could have passed flyers out.
Throw it at me! Throw it at me! We all would have known. It would have just been so much better. Far from the fact that it was an Indigenous player during Indigenous round. I mean, like, oh, my God, talk about blindsiding people. You come out of left field there, Adam. What are you doing, mate? You know, absolute farcical.
Could have just let us a memo.
You know, exactly.
5 seconds.
And we hear this, you know, time and time again through Parliament, through elected officials like that. You know, you must act a certain way. You must do a certain thing. You know, that, what do they call it? Respectability politics?
Yeah.
So let me just ask you, where's the respectability politics got us thus far?
Very little.
No, not at all. I actually feel like respectability politics is a way for whiteness to stay in authority.
Damn right it is.
Yeah. So
isn't it a way to chain you down?
It is. So it's like, oh, well, it gives you this facade that, yes, you can resist. Yes, you can do all that stuff. You can speak your mind. But do it in a way that still appeases to us.
That's right.
So it still centers on whiteness. And it's, I mean, really, respectability politics... Yeah, I don't think it changes anything.
Well, like, I think I remember you saying something that really, like, intrigued me about Majid Nawaz, who's coming, unfortunately, to Australia. You said, what was it? White supremacy in brown face.
Yeah.
In a brown face, like.
Yeah, and the thing is, when you, not so much about resistance, but more about using tokens, maybe, for their agenda, for the white supremacist agenda, they're able to say things like, oh, this person of color, this indigenous person, this black person, this, you know what I mean? Like, this Asian person. Oh, but they believe what we believe, so therefore we can't be that bad, you know what I mean? Like, that's
exactly, you know. And, us mob have had this done to us, you know, for, you know, 200 plus years, 220 years. And it's exactly right, you know. Christ, you only have to go back to Bennelong. You know, the story of Bennelong, you know, he was dressed up, he was taken overseas. Poor bastard died destitute and broken, absolutely broken, you know. It didn't get him anywhere. Pemulwuy, if I contrast that, Pemulwuy, you know, staunch warrior, resistance fighter, you know, died horribly himself, but gave it right back to the colonizers, just saying, look, I'm not putting up with this crap. This is rubbish, you know, I know which one I'd prefer, you know, and I know which one in terms of, you know, as we're sitting here talking about it now, I know which one creates, whilst at the same time creates a more sort of evocative reaction from those that are dead set against it, who are only pretty much in the game to protect that white power base, but they're never going to change in many ways. They're never going to change. You can never be white enough for them. Yeah. You can never be respectable enough for them. So I just think, well, learn the way they work the game and then work it harder than them.
And talking about that, I think Joe had a really, really good response. He wrote an article for NRTV during the week, and he said this: my response is this. Every year, January 26 is a political statement. Every single year, many Australians opt to celebrate being in a free country on the very grounds where my ancestors split blood and lost their lives, many lives. Every year, January 26 is a day when Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians are divided. How can we celebrate together on a day when the rest of the country is dancing on the shallow graves of our past? Once again, the Indigenous man is expected to be seen but not heard. Are people hurt because I didn't stand, or are they hurt because I made a statement as an Aboriginal man and chose to exercise my right in a free country? Never will I sit on my hands or remain silent when it comes to my people. And that is a really good note to end on. We're going to go to our next story in the week that was.
Right. And so David Morrison, former Chief of Army, was recently awarded Australian of the Year, and he has been applauded for raising the issue of the bamboo ceiling. For listeners who are unaware, the bamboo ceiling, coined by Jane Hyun, refers to systemic obstructions of Asian people in the workplace, where they can see, for instance, managerial positions but cannot reach them. The metaphor is a derivative of the term glass ceiling, used to denote the structural disallowing of women from reaching top positions. Asian Australians, for information, make up 10% of the Australian population, yet occupy less than 2% of senior executive positions in ASX 200 companies. While it is commendable that David Morrison would like to see more Asian Australians in top jobs, there are several topics of concern. From the awarding of a white man as a champion for diversity, and as the words go, pale, male, and stale, the juxtaposition of Asian and woman in the ways we imagine structural inequality and oppression, I mean, you know, the glass ceiling and the bamboo ceiling for Asian women is probably pretty similar. The economization of addressing oppression, that is, addressing oppression through a corporate lens, as well as ethnic nepotism and model minority. So there's a lot of things to talk about in this story. Ahmed, what are your thoughts?
Well, like, I saw this, and when I saw him winning the Australian of the Year, what I was like, champion of diversity, this white man. Hey, let's give all the jobs to the women and the ethnics. Oh, but, you know, like, I'm the one leading this, right? But, like, I don't want to make it about him, because, like, he's doing good work. But it's a question why he's been recognized ahead of, I think there was a transgender woman who's been working in the army and has done some incredible work. But she, obviously, they didn't win. He did. But but regarding the bamboo ceiling, I just wonder, like, we were talking off air about it, and it has potential for model minority. And why does he particularly want Asian Australians to get into these positions of power? Is it because China are a massive power? Is it because Japan's over there and Korea's there? Right. Is it more for financial benefit opposed to creating a more diverse workplace? And why would he just pick Asian Australians opposed to creating a more diverse more diversity for all ethnic minorities?
Right. So my theory is the interest in addressing the bamboo ceiling comes from a place of increasing trade relations with growing Asian economies. And it thus becomes convenient to tap into Asian Australians because somehow they have the insight, the language.
They know how to do math. They know how to do math, right? They can do the math for us, right?
Exactly. So they embody all these skills that they like. So it doesn't come from a genuine interest in ending racist economic practices. If that was the case, then maybe they would open it to, you know, all people in Australia, they not just, you know, Asian Australians. But also, I'm a little bit wary with the idea of just asking Asian Australians because there is already the model minority myth, which I find problematic to feed into, because that's the same myth that causes Asian Australians or Asian people of Asian descent in general. It actually furthers mental health issues. The fact that they have to constantly measure themselves against this idea of what they should be like. So what happens if you're Asian and you're not good at math? Then what happens?
Do you know the thing with the model minority that kind of bugs me is that people think model minorities are just Asian people, which is kind of odd. The reason people become model minorities isn't necessarily because they are a specific minority. It's because they're a specific minority that also have wealth. So I feel like the breakdown of class is kind of completely missed. Like, there can be, I know there are tons of African migrants that have come to Australia that have come as skilled migrants, and they're just as model minority as, say, X or Y Asian person in that situation. And I feel it becomes kind of like a situation where there could be this Asian family, and there's a lot of people come from refugee backgrounds, and just because they happen to be Asian, you say, hey, you're a part of the model minority, aren't you? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Or that you... Yeah, okay, I get it.
That's just a burning thought in my mind at that moment.
And the other thing that's on my mind is, you know, what does it say when your incentives for addressing inequality must be connected to corporate success for oppression to be worth addressing.
Thank you. Yes.
So.
No, I think that's a damn fine point and something that should be really unpacked on that, on just that level.
Yeah, I think it's. I think the problem with viewing, I guess, addressing oppression through corporate success is that in order to attain that, you would have to have some kind of privilege to attain that.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, whether it's class or whether it's, you know, having, you know, the right education, so to speak, or whatever it is. For me, I feel like there are so many people who will not even come close to that. There are people who fall through the cracks and their oppression won't be addressed.
That's what I mean. It's a great point to bring up. And I think it ties back to what you were saying about that model minority as well, is that, excuse me, is how, you know, in with us black fellas, we get a lot, particularly, you know, as a male, can you play footy? Can you do this? You know, there's all of these sort of physical attributes, and we hear that through, you know, the popular media, you know, back to Adam Goods saying, oh, he's magical, he's freakish, he's this. Well, what about all the, you know, the 30 hours, 40 hours a week he puts into it every bloody week? I mean, come on, you know. Yeah. Oh, you're Asian, you're good at maths. Yeah, because I do it 12 hours a bloody day. You know, I study it. I work my backside off for it, sort of thing. And then where you've also got, like, exactly that class structure that sort of sits in the background, as it were, where, as you said, you've got to come from that sort of acceptable pathway,
right,
sort of thing. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I've had, you know, not just in academic jobs, but like in professional jobs where I've gone into interviews and, you know, people have, you know, more or less, the interviewers have more or less understood, or I've told them straight out, you know, I'm an Indigenous man, Ngunnawal man. And they go, oh, right, okay. Oh, tell us your story. And you just sort of go like, I'm not your monkey. I'm not going to dance for you, you clown. You know? I just want you to look at my resume, see my abilities and my skill set, work out if I'm good for the job or not. Thank you very much. you know, sort of thing.
You know what you say about, like, Adam Goods and about, like, he spent how many hours a week cultivating his technique and his style, and he's playing AFL at that elite level, just as that Asian kid that honed his craft doing. But the thing is, like, if society tells you the only way you can seek success is through playing sport, therefore your reality will become that, because that is what you think you are. Because, like, perception becomes reality.
Exactly, and correct me if I'm wrong, that's the sort of point you were making about, like, the corporatization of it as well.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Exactly. And I think the white supremacist capitalist patriarchy basically rewards you for filling in those stereotypes. They reward you financially.
Can I ask you guys a question, seeing you've been asking me questions?
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you believe in diversity?
Or, like, I believe in a decolonized version of diversity. And I believe, like, we can't be hitting quotas for the sake of hitting quotas, and we have to change the way. Say, for example, the only way we can have diversity, if we have diversity, not only in just, like, oh, we have staff that are black and brown, you have to have diversity in positions of power. And also in those positions of power, like, for example, Barack Obama is the example, the golden, we're talking about respectability politics.
Yeah.
Barack Obama... He embodies it to a T. And if we're talking about whatever we're saying about Majid Nawaz, he does it to a T, because, like, this guy has set over his presidency, watched tons of black Americans die, has sent drones to like to Somalia, where my family's from, and other countries all around. Like, so exactly the things, like, we just can't have people in positions of power just because they're the one. We need a number. We have to change the way we see diversity, and that only changes when this, obviously this sounds very, you know, the system must fall, that kind of thing, but, like, ultimately, if a system is upheld because of white supremacy, that system must be deconstructed before it can, I guess, represent anyone other than the majority, if you will.
Right. My opinion is similar to Ahmed's. I'll probably take it a little bit further. Is that all right?
Oh, you can do it however you like. You can say, let's burn the bloody... I'm not going to say anything after that. Just, yeah.
So, I mean, I think my wariness comes from we tend to see diversity in relation to whiteness.
Yeah.
So we still put whiteness as the norm. And then diverse or ethnic or multicultural suddenly becomes word for everybody else who are not white, basically. And that's where I have an issue. It's no longer about dismantling the system. It's more like tacking on people.
You become an addendum sort of thing to it,
like
don't you?
Like an accessory.
Yeah, like an accessory.
Like a new key.
He's my Indian friend.
That's, right near, you know, my,
yeah, exactly.
My
yeah.
African
or,
friend.
Or things like, I ate Thai food today. You know, like, that's not the kind of diversity I'm kind of interested in. That's not,
My favorite food are dumplings, okay? Like, I always get them for lunch. What are you talking about, Avita?
So that's the place where I become wary with diversity. And also, just speaking on that, I feel like people think of diversity and multiculturalism, or they celebrate those things in terms of cultural goods and products, and not in terms of people. And unless that people can entertain you with cultural goods and products.
Exactly. Dance monkey dance sort of thing for me.
But apart from that, they don't really... If that is the only way they can accommodate for you when they talk of diversity... That's also another type of diversity that I don't particularly.
I'm banning all rap this year at the awards. Yeah! Don't get me wrong, I love hip hop. Obviously. But tonight, it's all about soul. Okay, hold on a second. I got another call. Wait a minute. Oh, Thugger! What's up, young Thug? No, honestly, man, you are my favorite artist out right now. But I ain't letting anybody in with no littles and youngs and their name. Yeah. Hang on one second. I'm sorry, y'all. Yes. Who is this? Iggy Azalea. Yeah, hey. Oh, no, you can come, because what you're doing is definitely not rap. Yeah. When I win, I win, no win, I win a big girl like she got hoes on call. Got hoes on call to come to take a protocol. Yeah, I got on my overalls. Yeah. In fact, I'm going to send an Uber for you right now. Yeah, come on, be outside.
So our feature this week is on memification. And if you're on social media platforms, you're probably already aware of what memes are. Basically a mode of cultural transmission. Memification is the process of spreading concepts and catchphrases, usually for the purpose of mimicry. I came up with that definition.
Mimicry? That's a good one.
Don't. That's not official. That's my interpretation of things. So what can sound like lighthearted internet humor can be rooted in more sinister underpinnings, particularly anti-blackness. And Ahmed and I, we talk about this often off-air.
Just like... I always see, it's not even like, I see a lot of white people on Twitter just use random black people as just, like, their memes. And then it's not always that you can't use a black person as your meme or a person of color. It's just that it becomes a form of circus. It becomes a form of you're using them, in a sense, to exploit them and exploit particular people. Because you would never use that particular meme to and you wouldn't use a white person in that sense, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, for example, how Michael Jordan has been reduced to teary eyes on an internet screen, like right now, and so many other people. And, like, you know, like, very kind of racist tropes like that, you know, like the sassy black woman. And you always see things like that on GIFs or memes and things like that. And it's just, like,
right.
It is, and it's, like, it's usually just tons of white people on Twitter or Facebook or whatever social media platform using this, and it's just, it becomes like, I just wonder, are you using it? Why are you are using that meme? Is that some? Is there some? Is there a subconscious kind of level of bigotry in that? Because whether you like it or not, we live in a place where we're socially conditioned to see certain people as less than human. So when we use those memes, are we just perpetuating that?
Right. And I also...
Oh, that might be very extreme for memes. But like people might be listening to this at home and thinking, oh, he's just making it.
Well, there's interesting research that's been done in terms of like social conditioning of children and just through the medium of children's books.
Mm-hmm.
So if I say to you, princess.
Oh, you obviously think white, blonde.
There you go.
Yeah. Sorry, I just had Cinderella in my head.
Yeah, see, me too. I could
bang,
jump.
Straight away.
I had
didn't
Cinderella.
It happened straight away,
yeah,
didn't it?
It did. Yeah.
And you didn't even have time to sort of second guess. I don't mean that.
Yeah. I mean, Black Princess.
It was bang, wasn't it?
Yeah, I know
this
what
is
you
true.
Mean.
This is
see
true.
See what I mean?
Yeah.
We're actually conditioned from such a young age. So in some sense, it may be subconscious in terms of that meme, but I wouldn't put that as a blanket
I
sort of
put it
reason
as a blanket
because I've seen some of these memes and I've seen, you know, the timelines of some of the people that do it, and it's not. They do it to hurt, to injure, to ridicule. They do, you know, and I don't need to jump inside there or psychoanalyze their heads. You can see it pure as, you know, the day.
Yeah.
Like from their timeline. They're bald-faced racists or bigots.
And I kind of see, like, more often than not, I see it in a sense of there's certain things that you can pick out, right? And you can say, there's something wrong here. But there's certain things like these where you just can't openly just say, hey, that's racist. You because there's going to be this thing where, you know, I'm just looking at the notes right now, sensitive. Like, that word just itself, you're being too sensitive. Oh, you know, you're making too much of it.
Do you cop that as well? Like,
Oh,
PC police, blah, blah, blah. I'm going, oh, yeah, PC,
social justice,
you know.
Warrior.
SJW, the way that gets thrown around, like it's some sort of, you know, pejorative term now.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, you know what? I'm a notorious care lord. You know,
I like that. I'm a notorious care lord.
You know, things like that. You know, where I'll play it right back, and others will play it, and you see it, and you play it right back to them. But or where people say, you know, oh, PC, you go, yeah, I mean, how dare we care about people? It's just outrageous, isn't it? Oh my goodness!
Like the worst thing
Who
that can
would
happen.
Want to treat people with respect?
I love that idea. And so useful on social media. Speaking of which, you know, I think the thing that strikes me, or the things that I think about, again, I think a lot about these things, is when we laugh at these memes, are we laughing by virtue of its humor, or the fact that it's by, like, featuring black people, that's the humor? Do you know what I mean? Like, I think people need to pick out where they find their humor from. Mm. Is it the fact that, you know, especially with the sassy black woman stereotype or that trope, the fact that that is so prevalent with memes, is that the reason why we find that meme funny? Is that the reason why we find that catchphrase funny? There's this one meme that is really popular, or at one point it was really popular, ain't got time for that or something like
that. Yeah, I know that meme.
Okay, so that to me, I mean, it sounds like an ordinary phrase, but the fact that it is positioned with a black woman, that's where the humor comes. You know, that's where people are getting entertained.
And yeah.
So I think people need to find where exactly their humor is rooted in.
You know, and like the thing is, like there's also this guy from ESPN, this African American presenter. I'm pretty sure everyone's seen him on the internet because he's memed so often, and he's very eccentric. And he uses his hands a lot. He moves around, and he's like very kind of like, you know, like he's out there, right? And he's meme to the hilt, and like in things that don't even have any kind of like, there's no kind of correlation to what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And you know why he's being memed. It's because he's being mocked. And just like, you ain't got time for that. You're being mocked.
Right.
And it's a sense of subtle mockery where... Yeah.
Well, there's a long history in it, isn't there?
Oh, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when I was sort of mentioning that there's a long history to it, I mean, you only need to go like... back a couple hundred years, you look at like 19th century cartoons or postering, and there's a very, very blatant racial superiority on the poster or in the cartoon.
Oh, definitely.
And yeah. You definitely see the sort of tapering off, hopefully, mm-hmm. the tapering off of that, that is still unbelievably still present. That hasn't been dealt with through memes, and right. we talk about right. how the medium's changed,
right.
but the sort of message may have just got a bit muffled a bit, but it's still there.
It's still
there.
Like,
know what I mean? Right.
Like I remember, it's slightly different to a meme, but just like a cartoon. And I remember when Chris Gayle
was being
you know what I mean? It was being sexist to Mal McLaughlin. The following week. He doesn't have teeth. He has a watermelon in his mouth, and we all know what that reference is.
Yeah, well, right. And I'm sure you heard. I'm sure you heard. You know, people going, "Well, why is that racist?" And it's like, "Oh my God, there's a complete and utter history here that has decried black people around eating watermelons,"
mm-hmm.
and you're going to say, "Oh, but it's just a joke," or "No, it wasn't attached to that." Sorry, it doesn't sit out of context that way.
Yeah,
yeah. And the thing is, the reason why he used those words, what were the words again?
What was
about the watermelon?
I forget the words.
Okay, but basically, he was linking Chris Gayle and watermelon.
Oh, definitely.
And it's like, that link is made very deliberately. It doesn't come out of nowhere.
He said, like, get this watermelon out of here. Something like that.
Yeah.
And it's like, you're linking, definitely. That link is so prevalent and it's so obvious.
I mean, if he said, get that peanut out of there, it wouldn't make sense. You know what I mean?
No.
Like, get that apple out of there, it wouldn't make sense. That the use of watermelon is very deliberate. So, and, you know, and I guess in the case of memes... a lot of that is also very deliberate in terms of constructing that humor and what we find humorous.
Yes, and I guess right now we're going to say our goodbyes. Thanks for listening to The Race Card again. And remember, you can find us on Twitter at The Race Card. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/RaceCardShow. You can find us on Acast searching Race Card, and you can find us on Mixcloud searching Race Card. And also you can find me at AhmedYusuf10 on Twitter. And I'm pretty sure they can find you as well, Darren.
Yes, you can. Darren Parker.
Is it Darren underscore Parker?
Yeah, underscore.
So under underscore, two underscores.
Two of them.
All right, and
I was going to let people sort of work for it, but now you're just giving it away.
I want you to get the followers, though. You know,
they'll find me if they want me, mate.
Now they will just find you. Darren's a really good Twitter. Follow him, and thanks for listening to the show. We'll be back hopefully next week. And that's bye from me.
Thank you for listening.
And goodbye. Travel well.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.